Well, good morning. We're back in the book of Daniel, beginning chapter 11 today. Daniel is probably, I haven't checked this out, but it's probably the longest chapter in the book of Daniel. Probably the number of verses and number of words. You know, like every verse had 8 or 10 lines to it, you know. You see, I've entitled the message Prehistory Events. That's similar to the word prehistoric. We talk about prehistoric man, or scientists do. What do they mean by that? Before history, there were men. Huh? I'm not sure if that's true, but before recorded history. Stephen's going to be a little more specific there. All right, so they talk about this, you know, what was before recorded history. All right, this chapter, in fact, a lot of the book of Daniel we've talked about, is talking about events that's going to take place, and they're recorded before they happen. So they're pre-history events. See, I've subtitled the message as the stomach churns. Those of you who are watch soap operas, remember what's the one called As the World Turns? This is kind of a play off of that title. A lot of stuff happening in this chapter. A lot of stuff that he gives us the revelation of the vision that is to come. And then when you look at the real history that happened, it happens all the time, I know, but you know, you just kind of get a mindful of it, you know, of reading through this chapter. I want to back up just a few minutes and ask you if you remember how Daniel behaved in the previous chapter as this angel appeared to him and began to talk to him. What were some of the things that Daniel did or said or whatever? Do you remember? What? Fell forward on his face. He was terrified, right? There's one place in there that says he was on his hand, his palms, and his knees on the ground. Can you imagine what it would be like to be? I mean, it's almost a feeling of humiliation to realize you're on the ground and you are terrified and you don't know what to do or what to say. And he is, several times he reacts out of extreme fear. And he's just in the presence of an angel, probably not in the presence of God at that point, but the effect is still pretty dramatic. This event that happens, not the prophecy that he's going to say, but the vision is given to him about 535 B.C. Now, as we've talked about before in the book of Daniel, there are always those who cannot stomach any kind of miracles in the scripture, any kind of prophecy, any kind of foretelling of anything. So as we discussed earlier in the book, they try to date this book in the 100s B.C. and as if someone told this account, as if Daniel had told it years ago when all they were doing was reciting what they knew to be history. Now, that's the one thing that is pretty well settled in this, about the accounts in this chapter, is that almost everyone will acknowledge that they took place in the next 200 or 300 years from when Daniel lived. Okay, the question is not whether or not this something fulfills this prophecy. The question is, when was it written? Right, and of course, we're of the opinion and belief that Daniel was given this vision 100 or 200 years before it actually happened, and that it's recorded prophecy. Last week, we saw probably for the first time in the book, not necessarily the presence of angels, but a little detail of some things that the angels were doing. And I want to talk a little bit about that. If we were to ask the question, what do we know about angels from the Bible? You can go through the scriptures and get tidbits of information here and there about what angels do or not do or et cetera. But I'll make two or three points. One is to be careful about the conclusions you draw from the activity of angels. Now we see in verse 1 right here of chapter 11, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I rose to be an encouragement and protection for him. Now, if you first read that and you're not familiar with the previous chapter, the context, you think that's probably Daniel talking. But it's not. It's the angel from the previous chapter. If you go back and look at the last few verses of the chapter, let's say, for instance, start at verse 20, then he said, this he is the angel that is there. Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. You remember he talked about that. So I'm going forth. Behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose. So it's the same guy still talking. It's not the Daniel. And you could go on and see it's obviously not Daniel as you continue reading the verses. So this verse 1 of chapter 11 tells us about this angel is saying that in the first year of Darius the Mede, he arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him, for Darius the Mede, right? Is Darius the Mede a member of the local Baptist church? I don't think so. Is Darius the Mede probably a believer in the one true God? It's doubtful. So here is an angel of God, not a fallen angel, but an angel of God who has a task of encouraging this unbelieving pagan national leader and strengthening him. Now, that's a little odd. In my way, I would have thought. I would think that God wouldn't be in the business of strengthening and encouraging unbelieving people, but here's one place he does, and that he has, and then I'm sure there are more. God has his plan. He has, and we're going to see in this chapter a number of times the phrase, as it was appointed, as it was appointed. And here we see that with this angel and his interaction with Darius the Mede. I doubt if Darius the Mede ever knew this was going on, but here it is. We see it here. Now, does that mean that you have your own personal angel that is assigned to strengthen you and to encourage you and to watch over you? Don't answer out loud, but the answer is no. You got it right anyway, Don. No, it doesn't mean that. You can read this verse, and it may be true of Darius the Mede. It is true of Darius the Mede, but that doesn't mean it's true of me. Okay, it might be. But it may not be. This is not a proof text to tell us that all of us have a personal angel. Everybody following me? Guardian angel. That's Rufus the Rooster. I told y'all about that story of Rufus the Rooster at the post office when he got killed. Someone said that now he's our guardian angel. I just turns my stomach. That's my stomach churned. That's how I heard that. All right, it doesn't mean that at all. Now, in my case, it'd probably take 10 or 15 guardian angels to keep me in line, right? And they'd go home every night and say, man, that dude's high maintenance, you know, right? On the other hand, another thing to be careful is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You ever heard that statement? Anybody know the history behind that statement? Let me tell you, see if you agree with me, Don. This is my guess, actually. Years ago, when I was a little lad, my family, I probably was a little poorer than other families, but my grandparents took a bath in a number 3 wash tub. They heated the water in the pot on the stove and poured the pot in the number 3 wash tub, did that 2 or 3 times, and then put some more water in it, maybe to keep it halfway warm. And then the family started taking a bath. No dumping the tub out after the first person. No dumping the tub out after the second person. It goes all the way down through the list. Now, in my day, my kids used to fuss about, oh, I don't want to get a bath. If I'd be living those days, I'd be volunteering. I'll go first. I'm first. But as it goes through the list, the baby, I think this is kind of how it works, the baby is last. You know why? The babies do things in the bathtub that nobody sure would want to get in the tub after them, right? And the phrase, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The baby's the last. You're fixing to throw the bathwater out because everyone's finished, and the baby's is the last one. It's still there. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Now, what that means is, the little saying means, don't throw away things that have value just because there is something that is trash around you. Right? Now, if my dad were here, I'd be preaching this to him. Preaching this to him. And for this reason, my dad, I got this gift from him of being critical and being judgmental and being assumption of people's agenda and stuff like that. And he just could not stomach phony people who were Pentecostal-oriented type stuff. You know, he had a lot of kin folks that jumped pews and did this, and it turned him away because he said, I knew how they acted Monday morning. And on Sunday, they were, you know, super in touch with God and all this kind of stuff, and then the rest of the week, they cussed and drank and all this other stuff. Right? And he wasn't too fond of the charismatic movement type stuff. And it's sometimes when it seemed like people had an obsession with mystical things and with spiritual things and with the warm and fuzzies and all this type of stuff and angels, he would tend to discount it as they were just phonies making it up to get attention. The problem is, 90% of the time, he was right. But occasionally, not so. And so that's what I'm saying here with this. Because we don't perhaps understand everything there is about angels, or we know it, people can go off into the deep weeds on this subject and how they look at angels and they see one behind every tree and all that kind of type of stuff. Don't take that to mean we should just throw the baby out with the bathwater. Angels exist, right? They are real. Demons exist. They are real. Just because I can't reach out and grab one doesn't mean they're not there. They really exist. But I don't think it should be a high priority of mine or of yours to spend a lot of time worrying about if you're doing what your angel wants you to do. Okay? Forget that. The Bible never tells you to stay in tune with your angel. All right? The Bible tells you to live a godly life. Spend your time focusing on what the Scripture says, how we are to live. Your angel can take care of himself as well as you. But here we are, Daniel chapter 11, and there's this angel. This angel who had been doing the activity of strengthening Darius the king and encouraging Darius the king. And now he's talking to Daniel. Now, I've got about a four-page thing here. And I know you're thinking, my gracious, we're going to be here forever, right? Now, on the left column, you'll see the verse that's numbered. The next column says condensed text. That condensed text is, I have taken, for instance, in verse 2, I have taken verse 2 and condensed the information that is there down to fewer words. To my knowledge, I haven't left anything out. I've just condensed it down to fewer words. And then in the next column, historical events or comments, I have given you some history that comes not from the Bible necessarily, some of it will, but not necessarily, but from historical records, that it's hard to say that these historical events do not run parallel with this prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. Now, the thing that amazed me as I was reading through this over and over several times is the amount of data, the amount of things that are here that is prophesied and that followed. I mean, every time they turn the corner, this angel is telling Daniel what's going to happen. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 300 years from now. And it looks like it happens. And we're not going to just go through and read the text. It's a long reading. And if we start running short of time, I'm going to not go through all of this because it's written in such a way that you can easily follow it later on. But let's just do two or three and get started here. Verse 2, the angel says, "Now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." Okay, so here's my condensed text. There's three more Persian kings coming. And then there's a fourth one. The fourth one is far richer and more powerful than the other three. And he's going to stir up all the kingdom against the kingdom of Greece. Okay? Here is, now I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I know dogmatically that this right column is the fulfillment of the left column. I'm just giving you the facts, and you can decide for yourself if you think that is its fulfillment. Here's some facts. There were three Persian kings. They're living in the one of Cyrus right now. Remember, Darius is just a puppet king set up in that province. Cyrus lived from or reigned from 539 to 529. The other one, and these names, I'm going to just kind of call them something, you know. Cambyses was 529 to 522. This next Darius was 521 to 486. And then the fourth one, who was far greater and far richer than the other three, was Xerxes. And this is the one in Ezra's day, 485 to 465. So you see, the first one was happening. Cyrus was reigning when this started. Three more Persian kings, he's the first one. Okay, then we get to verses 3 and 4. "And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded. For his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside him." So here's the condensed version. There's a mighty king who's going to come up for a short period of time. He'll rule with great power and do as he wills. After a short time, his kingdom will be divided into four kingdoms. None of them will be his descendants, and none will have the same power he had. History tells us that after those three Persian kings, Alexander the Great came on the scene. But 334 to 322, you see, it's 12 years there. He rises very quickly to power, accomplishes a lot of great things, and has influence that lasted for centuries, even till today, but he only rules for about 10 years. His kingdom did not go to his posterity, but was divided among four men. And the four men were Ptolemy, Seleucus, Philip, and Antigonus. None of those four were as powerful as Alexander. Now, as we keep going through here, I'm not going to go through the condensed text except occasionally, but I want to just kind of go through the history, and you can, while I'm talking, if you want to read the condensed text, but you can't. But in the next verses there, we're introduced to, through the rest of the chapter, what is called the King of the South and the King of the North. Now, that makes it a lot easier than having to say all these names. King of the South and the King of the North. The King of the South is one of those four men, Ptolemy, who took part of Alexander the Great's kingdom, and it was the southern part that included Egypt. So that's the King of the South. The King of the North is Seleucus, who took the area of this now Syria, or even then it was Syria, and that part of the world over there, north of there. Now, in between there, we talked about this several weeks or months ago as well, and you're really going to see it in this text as you read it. In the middle between those two, and none of these four kings seem to get along. They're always fighting for more of their share of the pot. And in between the King of the South and the King of the North, where they tend to the boundary between their kingdom tend to shift back and forth, was the area of Palestine. And so the Jewish people found themselves in the middle of a lot of squabbles. They found themselves in the middle of a lot of fighting that really wasn't their fight. But they were just in the way. They were there. Now, Ptolemy rules Egypt. You see the year and the names I've got in blue. He reigned in Egypt from 304 to 283. It says his prince, which is Seleucus. So it appears that initially Seleucus was not on an equal rule as Ptolemy under Alexander the Great. You got Alexander the Great, you got Ptolemy, and then you had Seleucus under him. It appears that way. But during the shift, after Alexander the Great died and the struggle for power here and there, Seleucus got his own place in Syria. So he's there from 304 to 281. You see, Alexander the Great, if they died in 322, these guys take power in 304, so that's, what, 18 years? That there's a struggle, a power struggle going on as somebody's trying to take control over this or over that. Okay, if you look on the... on the back page, and it's the same thing here. Ptolemy and Seleucus decide to make a truce. And the way they're going to do this is Ptolemy's granddaughter, and I don't know how you say it, Berenice or something. I tend to want to call it Bernice. Bernice, the granddaughter of Ptolemy, is going to marry Antiochus Theus, a grandson of Seleucus. Now, this happens all the time in Europe, has had for 1,000 years, where one royal family will enter or marry with into another royal family, and they all be hot shots for, you know, hundreds of years, right? And here's what they're trying to do that here. You know, let's make a pact together. My daughter will marry, my granddaughter will marry your grandson, and we'll all be one big happy family. All the while, they're both scheming to see that I want to be the top dog, though. All right, so they're going to marry. However, Antiochus is already married. So he's got to divorce his wife, Laodice, to marry this Bernice. And they do that. He gets divorced, and he marries her. And then within a couple of years, Ptolemy, back in Egypt, her grandpa, who's behind all of this stuff, he dies. And the whole scheme falls apart. But by then, Antiochus and Bernice have a son. Well, Antiochus, he didn't really want to be married to this woman, so I don't know how he gets rid of her. He gets rid of her, and he goes back and marries his first wife, she's not too pleased with his behavior for the last couple of years. And they get married, and she promptly murders him, murders Bernice, and murders the son, the young son that they had. Makes your stomach churn, doesn't it? All right? So that goes on. Then you've got Bernice's brother, Ptolemy, attacks Seleucus' son and carries home the spoils of war. And you go, I'm not going to go down through all of these things, but it's just back and forth. The Syrians attack the Egyptians, and the Egyptians come and attack the Syrians. And often, as they go through Palestine, they will take out their revengeful spirit, or they'll decide that, hey, we need some more food or whatever, and so they will plunder the Jewish people as they go to and fro. Or maybe they decide they need some women or whatever the case may be. So this is always happening as they go back and forth through there. Now, if you look on the text, condensed text thing, under verses 7 to 10. It says, a descendant of Bernice will arise and march to the north and prevail over them in battle. That's this Ptolemy, Eugene guy. He will carry many spoils from the north back to Egypt. The northern king will come to retaliate. Now, this is kind of how the text says this in the scriptures. But will return home. Doesn't say why he returned home. But three or four times in this chapter, you'll see that one guy was headed one direction, looked like he was going to really mop up on somebody, and then abruptly says, but he returns home. And every time, you could put in there, and I think be accurate, he returns home because he got his butt thrashed. All right? He returns home because he got whipped. And he returns home, and he's usually angry and mad and humiliated. One of them continued. So you got two sons of Seleucus who are going, they're from the north, they're going to go to the south, and they're going to wipe out the Egyptians. And one of them, I can read it over here, Seleucus or Saturninus is killed before they get started well. Antiochus continues wiping out Phoenicia and Palestine on the way. This comes from historical records. In the text, it says one of them continue and will overwhelm and pass through. Doesn't give you the details of where this takes place or exactly what it means, but from history you can see that more than likely what it was. It goes on, verses 11 to 13. The king of the south is enraged, goes out to fight with the king of the north. King of the south wins. He's lifted up with pride at how great and powerful and wonderful he is. And he says, cast down tens of thousands. The historical record tells us that the king of the south killed all the prisoners. He didn't keep his prisoners that he took. He just mowed them down and killed them all. So that's probably a reference to that right there. Now, verse 14 and 16, we come to an interesting phrase. And I'm going to read verse 14 from the scripture. It says, now in those times many will rise up against the king of the south. Notice it's many will rise up against the king of the south. It seems like there's more people mad at these Egyptians than just the Syrians. Other people are going to rise up as well. Notice the next phrase, the violent ones among your people. This is an angel talking to Daniel. He says, violent men from among your people will be a party to this, will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision. Let me back up just a second. So you see that as they go to and fro, there are Israelite men who partake in this. It's not that they're just caught in it, but they participate in this trying to defeat, in this particular case, the king of the south. And it gives the statement there, in order to fulfill the vision. Now, the question that obviously is raised, what is this vision? And to tell you the truth, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Some people tend to think that this is a precursor of an account of the Antiochus Epiphanes that will come later on, but I don't know. Don't know who that is. Now he goes on, verses 17 to 19. Antiochus comes, and he's going to Egypt. He's already destroyed and had some victories on the way. He took a fortified city, which most people think was Sidon, and he's headed on toward Egypt. And he decides to approach this a little different way. He's going to try to make a peace pact with the king of Egypt. So the text says that he gives the southern king a royal woman to help seal the deal, hoping to have a person, quote, on the inside. So he gives one of his granddaughters, or whoever it is, daughters, her name incidentally was Cleopatra, not the famous Cleopatra that we all have seen in the movies, I guess, but a different one. And her agenda is to eventually try to move her husband in the direction that the king of the north would want to do. Now look over there at the history. Antiochus hopes to control Egypt by political means and offers his daughter to 10-year-old Ptolemy V. Now I'm pretty sure his daughter is probably about the same age. I don't think she's adult woman at this time, but they arranged this marriage for these two young kids, and he's hoping that as they grow up and as they get older that he will still be able to influence her to what he's wanting her to accomplish as the time goes by. However, it doesn't work. She is loyal to her husband, and she has no interest in doing what he's wanting her to do. He goes on and goes a different direction and goes toward the west, toward Greece and toward Rome, and finds himself in a battle between some united forces of Rome and of Greece and of the Macedonian people. And he ends up biting off way more than he can chew. And you can see the last statement on that, verses 17 and 19 over there. It says, in the Treaty of Apamea, which was in 188 B.C., Antiochus lost all claims to Europe, most of Asia Minor, and agreed to stay east of the Taurus Range, which is in southern Turkey. So he didn't get very far past his home base. To guarantee his compliance, 20 hostages are taken to Rome, including his second son, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, we've heard of him. And here's how he first comes on the scene of history as a hostage taken to Rome. And then his father, Antiochus, dies in 187. Now, he is replaced or succeeded, I guess I should say, by, I think it's his son, Seleucus Philopater or whatever, who reigned from 187 to 176. Now look at the text in chapter or verse 20. Just an interesting verse, kind of stick here by itself. Then in his place, Antiochus's place, one will arise who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, neither in anger nor in battle. So here's this king who sends an oppressor throughout his kingdom. And the idea is to gather tax money, to gather funds. But this is a short-lived thing, and this king dies just in a short period of time. This all tells us just that in one verse. Now, the history, here's what we learned from history. Antiochus' successor is Seleucus Philopater, who faces a huge national debt from the wars of his father. His father has been at war with Egypt and other places for years, and that cost money. So now the nation is in debt. His father dies, and he plans to plunder Israel to raise money and sends this tax collector, Heliodorus, to collect taxes. Now, this comes from the history, not from the scriptures. This Heliodorus has a vision. And in his vision, he sees angels assaulting him. And I guess it scares him. And he packs his bags and goes back home and kills the king. All right, now, whether or not that's a fulfillment of verse 20 in our text or not, but it sure fits the dot, crosses the T's and dots the I's. It goes on. And eventually you come to Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes is a man that is well known in Jewish history. He's a man that most Christians who study the Old Testament very much or you study the history of the Jewish people have heard of and are aware of to some extent. Most people understand that he was a wicked and a vile man. But in reality, as far as the history of the world goes, Antiochus Epiphanes was just a little blip somewhere else. He's magnified in the Jewish tradition, in the Jewish history, and in our Jewish history because he touches our lives and he touches their lives in a way that the rest of the world never even knew existed or knew happened. So, let's read a little bit about Antiochus Epiphanes. I'm going to start reading in verse 25 in our text. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. And those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overthrow, but many will fall down slain. So let's look at this a minute. So you got Antiochus, who has a mighty army. He's headed south. He's going to meet this king of the south, who also has a mighty army, and they're fixing to fight it out. They know it's coming. But it says, but he will not stand, at the end of verse 25, he is referred to the king of the south. The king of the south will not stand because schemes will be devised against him. And those who eat his choice food will destroy him. You can see from history over here that, let's see if I can find it there. The king of the south, some of his people, some of those who are in authority under him, betray him. It would be those who eat his choice food, eat at his table. They betray him, and that's one of the reasons that Antiochus is able to defeat him. He goes on and says, verse 27, as for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but will not succeed, for the end is still yet to come at the appointed time. Now this reads like that these two rulers, these two kings, got together, kind of had a peace treaty. I had a talk. We're going to iron this out like they do in the Middle East, regularly. And so they're there trying to iron it out and agree on something. And all the while, it says both of them are lying to each other. Now, is that a surprise? That's kind of the way things work, isn't it? So this goes on. Okay. You can see under the comments on verses 25 to 28, Antiochus will defeat Egypt and on his way home, decides to act in an unholy manner in some way toward the Jews. He's won the battle. I guess he's feeling his oats. And as he goes through Palestine, as often the case, he decides to flex his muscles a little bit around these people. So he does so. All right. The comments over says this is the first indication of Antiochus' evil and hateful behavior toward the Jews. Perhaps the first really openly evil behavior. Verses 29 to 31. Antiochus decides once again to fight Egypt, but this time things turn out different. Ships from the west, these are Romans, come across the Mediterranean Sea, this time to help Egypt and confront Antiochus. He is disheartened and humiliated, and again we read those words, turns toward home. And again, you can supply what that means is he turns toward home because he's been humiliated, he's been defeated. And what actually happened there is Antiochus approaches Alexandria to fight there. He meets some messengers from the Roman Senate. And the Roman Senate tells him, don't do it. I don't know why he decided to listen. I don't know if they had a far superior army or somehow he was afraid of them. I don't know what it was, but the history tells us that they drew a circle around him on the ground and said, you're not going to step outside this circle until you tell us what you're going to do. I would take it from that they had his bluff, that they he knew they meant business and was able to back up this tough talk. So he turns to leave. Can you imagine how he felt in front of all his men, in front of all of his soldiers? He is enraged. He is infuriated to have egg on his face as he turns and leaves. As he goes back through Palestine, he vents his anger. Goes through Jerusalem. He goes in and wrecks the temple and sets up his own god. This is the abomination of desolation that is talked about in the scriptures as far as this time. He's there. And it's at about that time in history, 168, 167, that the Maccabeans, Judas Maccabean, the Israelites have had enough. They are sick of it. And they revolt. The Maccabean revolt takes place at that time. You can see, and I'm going to read the last 30 verses 34 or 33. I'm going to start there at 32. And by smooth words, one of the ways Antiochus was able to get things accomplished that he wanted to accomplish is by flattery. He would tell somebody this and build you up and make you think that he's on your side and he's not a bad guy and all this kind of stuff. And by smooth words, verse 32, he will turn to godlessness toward those, excuse me, let me start over. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. So there are some Jews who are not faithful to the covenant. And he knows who to seek out. He knows he's not going to get anywhere with the faithful Jews. But he somehow is able to tell the difference between those who really are faithful to the Jewish covenant, and the Jewish law, and those who are not, those who will set it aside in a heartbeat for a little gain of some kind. He turns, by smooth words, he turns to godless those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God, so here's the contrast, people who know their God and are faithful to their God will display strength and take action. And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. So here are godly people who see what's going on. And they recognize this is what's happening, folks. He's not, doesn't mean what he tells you. He's promising you all this stuff, but it's not going to happen. And so they tell their people, wake up, see what's going on here. And some of them listened, and some of them didn't. And some of those godly people who warned other people, it says here, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. So those who warned others, the godly people who warned them, Antiochus took them out. He kills them, he attacks them, he plunders them, takes everything that they have. Kind of sounds not too far ahead for us, doesn't it? Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end of time. Because it is still to come at the appointed time. Now, it is said from some scholars that this verse, verse 35, that's where we're going to end today, is sort of a transition verse. And they get that from that phrase, until the end time. And it's the idea is, like we saw in chapter 9, that there is all of a sudden, you're not talking about history in 168. But all of a sudden, you're seeing something that is going to take place beyond that. Okay? We didn't know how much beyond that. But as you read through the rest of the chapter, things are a little different. Things are worded a little different. And it's a little harder to make some of this fit in Antiochus' own day. Now, maybe it can, maybe it can't. But there's where a difference of opinion comes in looking at this as prophecy. We're going to take the rest of that up next week. So let's pray. God, your word has a lot of things. Lord, this chapter is just full of historical events that on their surface, Daniel had no idea what they were talking about, I suppose, or when they would happen. But we can look through history, and anyone who has studied this trying to make it not fit, it's hard to honestly do that. Lord, there's so much recorded history that just parallels this to a T. Father, it gives us faith in your word. It emboldens our belief in a God who knows all things. He knows yesterday, he knows today, and he knows tomorrow. And Father, it's a God who is able to accomplish what he intends to happen tomorrow and next week and the next century. So God, help us to learn. Help us to be encouraged. God, help us to, Lord, just marvel at what you have done through this man, Daniel. Amen.